Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
50 years ago this week, a stealthy band of operatives for the Committee to Re-elect President Richard Nixon burgled the Democrat National Committee offices in a Washington complex called Watergate. That caper, thwarted by an alert night watchman, and the cover-up that followed, touched off one of the greatest scandals in American history. It would lead to both criminal and congressional investigations and Richard Nixon's resignation 2 years later. The star witness in the case was John Dean, Nixon's young White House counsel, who became what he described as the desk officer for the cover-up. Dean implicated Nixon and the highest-ranking members of his administration. I sat down with Dean, executive producer and star of CNN's new documentary, Watergate: Blueprint for a Scandal, to recall those momentous events and talk about the lessons we should draw today. Here's that conversation. John Dean, it's great to see you. Welcome, first of all. Thank you for being here. I watched your documentary on CNN, which you executive produced and in which you starred, about Watergate and your journey. And it kind of reminded me of my own journey, because I remember being a college kid and watching Watergate unfold in the little television in our dormitory. And my first introduction to you, and most people's first introduction to you, was in that hearing room when, what, 80 million people were watching?
85, I think it was 85 million households. So how does that translate to
more than 85 million people?
More than 85, I guess.
Yeah, which is, I mean, actually, that's an important number to remember, because we have these hearings going on now on the 50th anniversary of Watergate this week. We have hearings going on about the insurrection and the President Trump's role in that insurrection. And these hearings are obviously very well-researched, very powerful, but I think 20 million people watched on the first night, and far fewer today. We're talking on Monday.
Given the fact that it was a morning hearing this morning, the West, it was very early. Now, that isn't what happened in the first hearing when they got 20 million people.
But 20 million is still not 85 million households.
It's not, but, and we hope it's not 20 million people who already know the story and already have resolved how they feel about it.
Well, we know that Fox News didn't cover it at all. They weren't going to displace Tucker for these hearings. So we live in a different time, and we will get to all that. But I want to go way back before we get to that and talk a little bit about you and your journey, because yours is such an interesting story to me. And I don't mean just the few years when you went through Watergate in the White House and the aftermath of that, but your story about how you got to that point to the White House. And I just want to ask you briefly about your life and your upbringing. I know your dad was sort of I don't want to use the word itinerant, but he moved around a lot as a corporate executive.
My father was a Carnegie Mellon graduate and had a talent for fixing corporations, that manufacturing corporations that were in trouble. He had a lot of practical knowledge, engineering knowledge, but a sixth sense of why a manufacturing company was having trouble manufacturing. So he would go in, fix a corporation, and then we'd move on to another one he'd take on. Today, he would be
private equity guy, huh?
Probably, exactly. He would do that, run it that way.
Let me ask you, though, for you as a kid, how was that going from place to place and having to reestablish yourself in different towns and so on. How did that shape you?
I don't recall ever being uncomfortable with the fact that it was something of an adventure. And then when we got at high school, I went off to private school. Mm-hmm. So then I was anchored thereafter, if you will. I kind of left home at 13, and my folks did their own thing, and I did mine.
Well, because I ask because, you know, and we'll get into this in a second, but I'd have to describe your rise in Washington as precocious. It was rapid. You had a talent for getting noticed. You had a talent for finding mentors. And I'm wondering where that came from.
It wasn't by design. I never looked for a job. They all came to me. It's a very curious thing. I went to Washington. What happened is my roommate in prep school was Barry Goldwater Jr., who was a lifetime friend.
His dad, this was before his dad, the senator from Arizona, had run for president.
Exactly. He was a junior senator. When I first met him, he was a junior senator, but a very popular one from Arizona. And Barry Jr. and I used to go from Stanton, Virginia, up to Washington and stop to see his dad and have a great time with his dad.
Is that when you got really sort of interested in, did you get the Washington bug?
That's when I got interested in Washington.
Yeah, what about it attracted you?
Well, I saw this handsome guy who people admired, and he got along great with his colleagues. We know that because when he did pass away, long after I'd first met him, they had to fill two planes to come out to his funeral. Yeah. He was very popular, but he was good company. He took Barry Jr. and I around the Senate, so we saw him in action. And I said, "This is a fascinating world," and talked to him. And he was of the belief that everybody should do public service. That you just don't bitch about the government. You get in and you work on fixing it.
But you like the scene. You like the energy around it, huh?
The whole thing was just fascinating. It was a world I had known nothing about. You know, introduced at the high school level, you're fairly impressionable, I guess. And that's where the impressions were made. And I said, "Hey, I want to follow this up."
You mentioned Goldwater. You know, he famously said when he was nominated in 1964 that extremism in defense of liberty is no vice. But you have to wonder how he would have dealt with this crowd today, you know, the Trump crowd. You know, he was a sort of libertarian.
He was a classic liberal is what he really is. He had, for example, had no opposition whatsoever to Roe. He could not have survived as a conservative in today's Republican politics. He had already turned on the evangelicals before he passed. He was in a real sort of pissy match with them, if you will. He thought they didn't belong in the Republican Party.
I think he stood up for gay rights as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Today, he would not be a Republican. He'd be drummed out of the party.
Interesting. He's such an iconic figure. You went to a couple of different colleges, but at Worcester College in Ohio, you went to Washington for a semester. So you obviously were cultivating that interest. You met your first wife, your future wife. She was the daughter of a very prominent Democratic senator,
right,
in Washington. And then you went to American University and you studied government. You got a master's degree, and then you went to law school, and all of this was in preparation to try and work in government and politics.
The elective route never attracted me. I knew there was a whole other appointed route that one could travel up the chain, and I'd always promised the senator when I got my first job at the House Judiciary Committee. When we first talked about it, after I told him I was there, and he said, "You got to promise me that you won't stay in government more than 5 years." And I said, "Why is that?" He said, "Well," he said, "I've seen too many guys like you who have lots of ability and should be in and out of government and not make a career of government." And so I made the promise. And actually, when I got to my five-year point, I went in and told Haldeman, chief of staff at the White House, that I was going to leave government. And he said, no, you're not, unless you want to be an enemy of this administration.
Oh, well, and you knew that they kept a list of their enemies, so he was serious about that.
I knew that the list that they sent to me ended up in my desk drawer. But so the enemies project that Nixon had, that was a bomb I dropped the second day of my testimony, knowing there'd be an overreaction to it and knowing that really little was done in that area. It got way overplayed and has historically been never very well corrected.
Although one of the conversations that you reported was a conversation with Nixon before the 72 election, in which he said he thought that the administration had gone too light on their enemies and would, in the second term, he was going to deploy the power of the Justice Department and the power of the FBI, I guess he'd
right.
Maybe the IRS.
This was my first meeting with him during Watergate. It's my first meeting with him where it's basically he and I talking. Haldeman is there.
H.R. Haldeman, and Bob Haldeman is chief of staff.
Chief of staff. And it's, as I have said, it is the most embarrassing comment on all the recordings I have. I have 37 conversations with Nixon.
It was a suck-up line, yeah.
It's a pure suck-up line.
You said that's an exciting prospect when he said this about using the other side of it is not what it said about you, but what it said about him. And, you know, we live in the era of Trump. The idea that these agencies were at his political disposal obviously is at the core of Watergate. And it is this thing that he and Trump share in common. They both believe that all of these tools should be available to them for their political use.
That's true. But what happened with Nixon is because of Watergate, he never got there. He ended up being in the mess he was in and never became the implementer of his enemy's project that he dreamed of being.
Before we get into that, I just want to get you to the White House, because you mentioned you did a brief stint at a law firm in Washington. You had kind of a messy departure from that law firm over some business dealings that the law firm thought were a conflict of interest.
Right.
But how did you end up as the chief counsel of the House, minority counsel to the House Judiciary Committee?
I started in my senior year of law school looking on the Hill for a job. And the reason I ended up going to that law firm is I didn't find a job I liked. I didn't want to work for a member. I wanted to work for a committee. There's a huge difference being on the professional staff of a committee versus being an aide to a member. And I had turned down an interesting clerkship in hindsight. I'd been interviewed by Judge John Sirica.
No kidding. Who ended up being like a heroic figure in the whole Watergate saga.
He would later sentence me in his courtroom. that's how ironic it is. And I had turned him down. He had offered me the clerkship and never understood why I didn't take it.
Maybe he would have treated you better if you had taken the clerkship.
Well, I went back to the dean at Georgetown and told him, I said, he's a nice guy, but he's just not very smart.
Oh, God. That's a great story. After the Judiciary Committee, you became the director of the National Commission on Reform of Federal Criminal Laws, and you helped rewrite the criminal statutes.
I wrote a law that created the National Commission to Reform the Federal Criminal Laws, and it was the only piece of Republican legislation in a Democratic Congress that got out. And what happened, and I'd just been reading some articles in law journals, wherever, and so I went to the legislative office and I said, let's design a law that will clean up a lot of these problems. And a guy by the name of Dick Poff from Virginia,
mm-hmm. Congressman,
jumped on it and ran with it. And as a result of its passing, he was selected to be on it. And he said to me, we've got this thing now. You got to help me and you got to go down there and make sure this is all Lyndon Johnson's people and Democrats, that we don't get in some kind of trouble with this thing. So he twisted my arm to go down and sort of at least be the administrative head of it. I had no background in criminal law at all, other than having read that it was a mess. And I agreed it was. So I'm there during the 68 campaign, and there are lots of academics who are feeding stuff in, which I'm in turn sharing with some of the people I know that are working with the Nixon campaign.
Then when Nixon won, though, you were on their radar screen, you moved around and you moved up pretty damn fast.
Very fast. And the way I got to the Department of Justice is on New Year's Eve day, I get a call from Nixon has just won the race, and he's putting together his presidency. And I get a call from Richard Kleindienst, who is the Deputy Attorney General designate, and he asked if I would come to New York and meet with John Mitchell, the Attorney General designate. They would offer me the 13th level job at the Department of Justice.
You got close to John Mitchell, who was the Attorney General, because you were doing their legislative work on the Hill.
Well, what happened really, the way I got closer, I got to know the people at the White House, because neither Mitchell nor Kleindienst liked to do background briefers at the White House, particularly for the legislative program that they were putting together. They found I was a fast study, and they would send me over to do these background briefers, I'm just a spokesman, right, from the Department of Justice. And that's where I meet the White House staff. That's where I meet Haldeman, Ehrlichman.
So let me ask you about this, because in 1970, you're 5 years out of law school. You're 31 years old. They invite you to come and be White House counsel to succeed John Ehrlichman, who is, as close as anyone to the president. And the question is why? And whether or not, I mean, I've seen a lot written about the fact that they thought that you would be a good factotum, that you wouldn't rock the boat, that you didn't know too much to be a problem for them. What do you think they thought they were getting in you?
When they offer me the job, Bud Krogh, who was an Ehrlichman aide, he said, would John Mitchell let you come over to the White House? And are you interested? And I said, well, Bud, why aren't you getting that job as counsel to the president? You're a deputy counsel now. He said, because I'm going with John Ehrlichman as an assistant to the president on domestic policy. I immediately figured out what's going on. What's happened is that they want to get rid of the grunt side of the work of the counsel's office, and they're going to, the guy who's going to remain for all practical purposes as Nixon's counsel is John Ehrlichman. And
right,
I'm going to get the title of counsel to the president. At 31, I couldn't turn it down. When I raised it with Mitchell and Kleindienst both, they said, you're getting the title, you're not going to get the job. I said, I appreciate that, but how in the hell do you turn down that title at 31? No one knows how. It's all gray what happens inside those gates at the White House. So you know that as well as I do.
Talk about some of the things that were underway while you were there, particularly the plumbers unit that was developed to deal with leaks.
What happened, David, is when in July of 1971, after Daniel Ellsberg had leaked the Pentagon Papers, the study, the highly classified study of the origin.
And critical study.
Critical, but highly classified,
yes,
study of the origins of the war in Vietnam, which did not affect Nixon. It was not critical,
right,
of Nixon in any way. It was critical of the Democrats for lying.
Kennedy
to the
and Johnson, yeah.
Right. Anyway, after that leaks, one day, Jack Caulfield, who is just roams around, he'd worked for Ehrlichman, he's on my staff budget but doesn't really do anything for me. But he comes into my office wide-eyed and says, John, you got to help me. I said, "What? How so?" He said, I have just come from Colson's office, and Colson wants me to firebomb the Brookings Institute. And I said, "Come again?" And he explains that Colson has got this
Charles Colson, Chuck Colson. He's a top aide to the president.
Top aide. He's the president's well-known hatchet man.
Yeah.
And a fairly ruthless character in attacking the president's enemies, if you will. But anyway, he says, Colson wants me to break into the Brookings because the president wants some papers in the file in the Brookings. And what the game plan is to go in, firebomb the place. When the fire department responds, before they get there, we'll have a group that will go in pretending to be firemen and get in the safe. I said, Chuck, I said,
he wanted Ellsberg's papers.
Sensitive information that he thought was harmful. I tell Caulfield, do nothing. Don't touch this. And I fly. I try to reach Ehrlichman on the phone. He's not there. I get on the courier flight to San Clemente. Goes out to one of the Air Force bases and then takes me up to San Clemente and wait for Ehrlichman to come back in on Monday morning and to tell him, you know, John, this is a crazy scheme that Colson is cooking up. And he picks up the phone and says to Chuck, he says, young counsel Dean is out here, doesn't think the Brookings plan is a very good one, cancel it. Boom. Puts the phone down. Said, anything else? I said, that'll do it. And I left. But what I learned later is because of my actions, they when they decide to create the plumbers unit, everybody's given specific instructions. Don't tell Dean about what you're doing. He's a little old lady.
And so they created this unit, G. Gordon Liddy, former FBI man, E. Howard Hunt, former intelligence officer.
These guys were already working at the White House. So they bring them down to this special unit that Bud Krog is given. He is co-director with David Young, who's a former Kissinger aide. And the two of them are instructed by the president, it's on tape, obviously, today, that he wants to deal with leaks. And he wants to deal with it in a fairly ruthless manner. They're also monitoring the FBI's investigation of Daniel Ellsberg to see purportedly if he had also had contact with the Russians. They believe that. And when they learn that the FBI is unable to get anything out of Ellsberg's psychiatrist, who they interview, and he naturally claims the patient privilege, that's when they cook up this scheme. Howard Hunt, who you've introduced, mm-hmm. and Gordon Liddy, who you've introduced, cook up this scheme to break in this doctor's office to see what is in his files about Ellsberg. And they come back and sell this to first to Bud Krog and David Young, who in turn write it up and take it to Ehrlichman for approval, who approves it in a handwritten note saying, so long as I have your assurance that it is not going to any way connect to the White House, which, of course, you've already connected it to the White House with that very statement.
So in the beginning of 1972, there was a big meeting at which, you know, these same guys, Liddy, I guess, he goes over to the campaign. Ostensibly as counsel, but it's really to kind of lead an effort of political espionage over there.
In working on the documentary on all this, I corrected things that were wrong, and 98% of them were accepted. One of the things that's wrong that got in there, that Liddy's only assignment at the reelection committee was to be in charge of intelligence. That is exactly the opposite reason they sent him there. The true story, which I put on film, is that John Ehrlichman and Bud Krog knew they had to get Liddy out of the White House. Once he bungled the break-in in Ellsberg's doctor's office, he has implicated the White House in a serious felony on multiple levels, but both a federal crime and state crimes, California crime. Liddy's mission, Liddy goes to the reelection committee, and he really goes as a general counsel, but he doesn't want to do the work. And they try to fire Magruder. Says, I need a general counsel. He was the deputy director. So when they realize Liddy is not up to the task, they hire another guy, a deputy, they know who will do it. And Magruder gets into fights with Liddy all the time, and they want to remove him. The person who saves him is a guy by the name of Fred LaRue. And Fred says, well, we got to keep Liddy because he's doing our dirty tricks for us. And so that's how, you know, that's why they keep him.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. Did Liddy outline? Did he outline for all of you? It's been reported in places that he outlined for a group of you what he wanted to do.
It's one of the most amazing meetings I've ever attended, not only in government but anywhere. And Liddy is over there with an easel set up in the Attorney General's back office, and Liddy begins this pitch. And he calls the operation, this is his gemstone operation. And there are things like intercepting ground-to-air communications with a chase plane for the opponent campaign operation. He's also, at that time, there were really a lot of demonstrations, anti-war demonstrations. He's got a solution he offers Mitchell. He said, we plan to kidnap the leaders of the anti-war movement and take them below the border, drug them and take them below the border. He's got a plan to lease houseboats down in Miami at the convention where the Democrats are holding their convention. And he'll have a squad of prostitutes lure Democratic leaders. Could have been a David Axelrod.
Not me, brother.
Lure them to this houseboat where he would have a two-way camera mirror situation. And somehow they would reveal the inner secrets of the Democrats' plans, you know. And
wasn't one of them that he wanted to put listening devices into the Democratic headquarters?
A week or 10 days later, I go back after that meeting and tell Haldeman what's happened in Mitchell's office. And I said, this is crazy shit. I mean, this is just off the wall. And he says, I agree, you should have nothing to do with this. And what happens is Magruder calls me and says that Liddy's coming back to Mitchell's office, and you should probably hear his plans. So I go up to Mitchell's office, and Magruder and Liddy are huddled around Mitchell's desk, and they're talking about things like electronic surveillance at the Watergate. And I said, at that point, I said, hey, you guys are talking about things that should never be talked about in the Office of the Attorney General of the United States. Just poured cold water on it as fast as I could. And I go back and tell Haldeman what I've done again, because I think the White House should be clean of this. This is not the kind of things that should get dragged into the White House. So that's the last I heard about it until June 19th, when I return from Manila after 2 days after the arrests at the Watergate on June 17th of 1972. And it doesn't take me any time at all to put together the pieces.
I mean, what's phenomenal to me, and I think, you know, I remember it. I remember, obviously, the Post was very aggressive in covering it and so on. But Liddy, Hunt, former operatives of the CIA, this thing was so rife with scandal. But you undertook to try and tamp the story down.
I didn't have to tamp the story down. Only a paper covering the story was the Washington Post. So the Post, and it was a Metro story in the Post that often made it to the front page, but the national reporters didn't cover it at all. And there's no real national coverage of it throughout the campaign
You talked about becoming the desk officer for the cover-up. The first thing that you had to confront was the fact that these burglars needed to be paid off. They needed to pay for their lawyers. They needed...
There's a tape. I have the benefit now of having listened to every Nixon tape relating to Watergate. He is the one who says these people are going to need to be taken care of. And he said, what I want to do is I'm going to call B.B. Rebozo, who was his best non-government friend, who had deep ties to the Cuban community. And the men who had been arrested at the Watergate were Cuban Americans. Hunt and Liddy were not arrested at the time. That comes much, much later. But so initially, Nixon says, I want to set up a defense fund for these people, which were very common at the time. And Nixon said, have Beebe set that up, draw on the Cuban community down there that hates McGovern, and make a political issue out of it. Meanwhile, Mitchell is getting pressured by Liddy to start taking care of these people. What happens is Liddy confesses to me, he said, nobody's going to talk. I'm pretty comfortable on that. But John, you should know something. While I was working at the White House, I did an operation for Ehrlichman, a national security operation, where we broke into Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office. Two of the men I used in California at that operation are now in jail because I used them at the Watergate. He said, we need to get those men out of jail. I said, well, Gordon, there's nothing I can do on that count. It's just, I don't know how you're going to deal with that. And I went back and told Ehrlichman, and he just played it as poker-faced as can be, not even acknowledging he knew about the Ellsberg break-in.
But now you're engaged. You have to solve this problem.
I don't know all these problems at that point. As I say, the desk officer, I'm picking up information and sharing it back and forth.
And at this point, John Mitchell, who was Nixon's old friend, had resigned as attorney general, right, to become his campaign manager.
And Ehrlichman and Mitchell, their dislike of each other is why I became the desk officer. They can't talk to each other even. They don't want to talk to each other. They don't trust each other. Ehrlichman has, from day one, tried to influence Mitchell in how he runs the Department of Justice unsuccessfully. Mitchell doesn't want Ehrlichman telling him now how to run his campaign. So I become the middleman, and that's how I get drawn right into this thing.
And so you had to find ways to get financing and so on.
Mitchell comes to me and says, we need to activate Herb Kalmbach, who was the president's personal lawyer and a large fundraiser for the reelection. So Mitchell wants me to go to Haldeman and Ehrlichman to say that he needs Kalmbach to raise money to take care of these guys. So I do that. And do I think it's criminal at that time? No, I didn't. I thought it was a defense fund. Was I stupid? You bet.
But over time, John, you get deeper and deeper in.
When I go in with both feet is after the election. First of all, there was never any grand meeting where everyone sits around and says, we got to cover this up. Obstruction of justice is necessary. First of all, nobody had ever heard of obstruction of justice. Watergate puts that crime on the map. Also, nobody had ever thought that the White House could be investigated. I knew Henry Peterson very well, who's the head
of the criminal division.
Henry Peterson is keeping me informed.
So just giving you all the details of their investigation?
You know, it was a different era than post-Watergate. You know, he's telling me that, you know, the FBI has no business over there, John. If Hoover were alive, they wouldn't dare be pounding on your doors, things like that. So I just don't have the background to know these things. But I do jump in with both feet, knowing it's obstruction of justice after the election, because Chuck Colson, who we've introduced, comes to me after the election. Colson comes to my office and he has recorded a conversation, a telephone conversation with Howard Hunt, and he plays it for me. And he's pleased as punch because Hunt exonerates him. So Chuck is thrilled to have this. But what troubles me is Hunt says, listen, Chuck, this thing is going to break apart for foolish reasons, because we're not getting paid money that we should be getting paid, in essence, to remain silent. And as soon as I heard that, I said, that's either extortion or bribery. I don't know which one, but I better get my fingers walking in the law books. And that's when I find, indeed, obstruction of justice, and that we're obstructing justice. I have just been married about 2 weeks.
Right. You've just gotten remarried.
Had I thought I was involved in criminal activity, I would have never married the woman I've now been married to for 50 years and have apologized to her for the hell I put her through from my own stupidity on what I knew and didn't know. Anyway, after I find the obstruction statute, I go right over, I make a copy of it, go right over to Ehrlichman's office and say, John, we are in trouble. We're paying for the silence of people who should be in front of the grand jury. As I said in the documentary, it's hard for me to believe that he went to Stanford Law School, where his classmates were William Rehnquist, former Chief Justice, Sandra Day O'Connor, and he somehow missed a day when they taught about criminal intent, because he says to me, he says, John, we're not violating that statute because I have no criminal intent. I said, John, I don't think you understand criminal intent, and walked out realizing I'm going to get no relief here. But what I also realized, I'm in a lot of trouble. We're all in a lot of trouble. I got to make this cover up work. That's when I do the really stupid things, like destroying Hunt's notebooks.
Yeah, Howard Hunt, you went into his safe at the, he had an office in the White House complex.
The notebooks had somehow been left in my safe, and I find them amongst the president's estate plan. And I don't even study them, don't want to know, shred them. And know I'm probably obstructing justice, but I got to make this thing work. So yes, that's when I start doing clearly, knowingly criminal activity. And it ends, however, when Howard Hunt gets wind and he sends a message to me through one of the lawyers at the reelection committee. And this reelection committee lawyer says to me, he said, Howard Hunt wants to send a message to you that if he doesn't get paid $120,000 like yesterday, he's going to have seamy things to say about what he did for John Ehrlichman while working at the White House, and by implications, probably others. And O'Brien says, what are you going to do about that? The guy who brought the message, I said, I'm not in the money business anymore. I'm not going to touch that. In fact, Paul, I'm likely to blow this whole thing up. This is stupid. This is endless. You and I are carrying all these messages around. We've got ourselves in deep trouble, and I'm going to try to get the president to end this thing. And that's what I did.
On March 23rd.
March 21st.
And you go in, and that's an extraordinary conversation. That's when you warn him that there's a cancer close to the presidency. It's growing daily. You explain the whole scenario, including Hunt's demand. And what did you expect the president to say to you in response?
I thought at some point his hand would come down on the fist would come down on the desk and say, this is crazy. This isn't behavior we can engage in. I was trying to raise one horrible after another horrible after another horrible until at some point he did that. This is also the day I think I met Richard Nixon, who he really was. I think he had played games with me and tried to have an image of himself in front of me. But this is where I really saw who I'm dealing with.
He asked you, tellingly, instead of saying, we're not going to pay, he asked you how much you thought it would take to keep
I kept telling him this could go on indefinitely. He said, well, how much could it cost? And I pulled out of thin air what I thought was a number he defined offensive. I said, well, it could cost $1 million. I'd never even contemplated how much it might run. And his reaction cut me even more. I can hear on the tapes my own gasp at times. I'm not selling him. I'm trying, you know, I'm dealing with the leader of the Western world. I'm 30, some mid-30s. I'm dealing with a man much my senior. I don't want to push too hard and say, what the hell are you thinking, Mr. President? This is crazy stuff. But rather I tell him, you know, it could cost $1 million. And he said, John, that's no problem. I know where we can get $1 million. In fact, what happens, I know from later, from doing other tapes, is he goes into Rose Wood's office after I leave, yeah, and says, how much do we have in the slush fund? And he also goes to one of the people who is funding the secret payments and thanks him and tells him we may need more after I leave that meeting. So, you know, I totally failed. And, you know, I thought I created a hurdle he couldn't get around. When I realize it's not working, I'm telling him, Mr. President, people may have to go to jail. That's where we are. And he says, like who? And I said, like me. And he goes, oh, for the obstruction thing, I don't believe that. That's not going to happen. So he doesn't even want to hear, but I know I've left the message that the president's counsel thinks he's on his way to jail. Makes it me a little bit radioactive, at least.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. That conversation you had led to the sort of decisive weeks of your story, in that you got called back by the president just a short time later, and he called you over to his office, not the Oval Office, but in the Executive Office Building in the evening.
April 15th. This is after I get wind that they don't know what to do with me. And they just say, we'll make him responsible for the cover-up. So I have my secretary call the lead newspapers, New York Times, Washington Post, AP, and issue a statement that I won't be the scapegoat of Watergate. And if they don't understand that, they don't understand me, or they don't understand how the system works. And so Nixon, by the 15th, he wants to know more. So I go in after to meet with Nixon late at night. He's been out on the Sequoia with Beebe. They've been drinking. I can smell alcohol in his breath. It's a very unusual conversation in that he's got a legal pad with a bunch of questions for me in his lap. And he starts through these questions. And the most glaring example of what he was doing, of trying to get me on record in a way that was less harmful to him, is he said, you remember that conversation we had when you told me there was a cancer on the presidency and we were talking about these guys demanding money and you said it could cost $1 million? Well, you didn't know when I said we could get that. I was just joking, didn't you? And I said, well, I didn't take it that way at the time, but that's what you say. And then at one point, he literally gets up from his chair and in a stage whisper across the EOB says, John, I was foolish to talk to Chuck Colson about clemency for Hunt, wasn't I? And I said, yes, Mr. President, I think that's probably obstruction of justice. That's the moment I said, this is being recorded. I said, those leading questions, very unlike the prior conversations I've had with this man. And he knows the answers. He's not liking the answers I'm getting. So he now has a question he doesn't want recorded. So he's going across the office, but he wants my answer.
And then was it the next day that he called you in and pushed a resignation letter in your direction?
Virtually, yes.
So, but what did happen was you realized that you were cooked and you began cooperating with federal prosecutors and ultimately, famously,
what happened is I realized I wasn't going to convince anybody in the Nixon White House to come forward and end the cover-up. And so I was going to blow it up, including meeting with the prosecutors. told them that. I wanted to up the stakes for them.
But there also, you had self-interest here as well because...
Oh, you bet your boots.
Yeah. When you were helping to rewrite the criminal code, there was a provision that was inserted there for limited immunity, use immunity. So if you offer testimony that is helpful, that testimony, you could be immunized for the things that you testified to. You were aware of that, obviously, at the time that you approached the prosecutors.
Totally aware of it. And my lawyer, Charlie Schaffer, understood that very well. And we went initially in working with the prosecutors. I was given equitable immunity. That's when the prosecutor just says, you can come in and talk to us and we won't prosecute you for anything you tell us. And we very quickly found out that this wasn't going to go anywhere. So I also knew Sam Dash, who had been involved.
Who was the counsel to the Senate Watergate Committee, select committee to investigate Watergate.
Right. He was intimately familiar with the immunity statute and had said to Charlie, if John has the kind of testimony I think he does, he fits as a ideal person to immunize. There is just no way the government could have prosecuted me. Charlie was confident of that, had I decided not to plead. But I had decided to plead from the get-go. I'd actually gone to Schaffer to negotiate a plea because I knew that these guys were going to lie. I knew I was prepared to take responsibility for my own activity. I didn't think anybody else would, but I thought I would just go in and be that much more dangerous if they knew. I knew I'd end it all if I was prepared to plead.
We referenced this at the beginning. I can't communicate strongly enough as someone who is a young person, then paying a lot of attention, watching your testimony, how stunning it was. It also was lengthy, 60,000 words, 245 pages. You read every bit of it.
Well, I hadn't planned on that. I didn't. If I had known they were going to have me read the entire statement, it would have been maybe 6,000 words at the most. No idea that I'd have to read that whole thing. It took like 8 hours of steady monotone reading to get through it.
So you essentially indicted the President of the United States in your, and a lot of other people in your narrative. But the thing that probably was the most significant was you aired your suspicion that there was this taping system.
Turned out to be, you know, a line that I really debated whether to put that in because it was speculation on my part. I didn't know for a fact, and I was trying to just deal in pure knowledge, something I could support. But that was a bootstrap, and I told my lawyer I was going to do it. He said, do it.
Yeah, it took almost a year for those tapes to finally emerge because obviously Nixon understood what the import of those tapes were as well. But the thing I wanted to ask you about was that firing of, so there were the special prosecutor, Archibald Cox, was determined to get these tapes. When he pressed the issue and said he was going to pursue them, the president ordered him fired. The attorney general, then Elliot Richardson, refused. The deputy refused, and he was fired. Richardson resigned. I remember how stunned the country was. This happened on a Saturday night, and it seemed unthinkable. It seemed like I raise it because we live in the Trump era now. You saw some of the things that he did. He fired the FBI director. He had designs at the end of his tenure. We're learning now, and we learned in books and reporting that he wanted to replace the acting attorney general and insert someone who would support his, you know, his lie about the elections. So it does. This is a good point, a good time to raise this question with you, which is, how do you view Trump through the lens of your experience and your knowledge of Richard Nixon? They both were trying to subvert democracy in some ways. Do you think that Nixon's his anti-democratic tendencies, how do you compare him to Trump? I mean, obviously, he was much more rooted in government and so on.
As a result of my experience, where I watched my colleagues and my peers click their heels, salute, and go off and do stuff, like firebomb the Brookings Institute, like start tax audits on hundreds of people, just blindly doing those things with no, where I know from knowing them that they had morals. They knew the difference between right and wrong. I never understood why they did those things. So that got me into studying authoritarian personalities. And I visited that subject again with a title just before that was done just before the last election called Donald Trump and His Authoritarian Followers. He indeed, I don't think, saw until he went out and became himself, because he's a poster boy for an authoritarian personality. He didn't realize that there were so many people out there that would be willing to unquestionably follow him. And we see that today. These are the kind of people who will accept the big lie and run with it and not have a qualm about it. It's a fluke that they can get control of government, but it's the fluke of our system where we have an electoral college, and you don't need a majority to control the government. So we have right now a minority that is capable, or was capable during the Trump years, of controlling. I think we're more alert to that now, and it's not as likely to happen. But the other thing about these people is you can't convince them they're wrong. They were embarrassed before to surface as they are now. Not any longer. Trump has given them permission to be out there. We have our white supremacists that get arrested regularly and are proud of it. And these are tough times, because authoritarianism is going to challenge a fragile government, a fragile system of government, as our democracy is, like it's never been challenged.
48 years ago, Nixon was forced from office, and he was forced from office because after the tapes were released, your friend, Senator Goldwater, and a delegation went down to the White House.
I've talked to the senator about this. Remember the conversation vividly. He said, you know, first thing we get down there, and Haig is then the chief of staff. And Haig gets us in his office and says, for God's sake, don't tell him it's time to go. Don't tell him that. He's almost there. He's talking to the family about it, but if you push him and force that issue, he'll turn around to 180 and his back will get up and he'll never go. So this is delicate. And so Goldwater said they didn't push at all. When asked what they saw the vote count, they told him how dire it was, but they didn't tell him he had to go.
But here's my question. President Trump was impeached twice. There were votes in the Senate twice. There was one Senator, Mitt Romney, who voted to impeach him in the first instance. There were seven, I believe, in the second. Would Richard Nixon have survived in today's environment, the balkanized media environment, the deep polarity, Fox News? Would he have been able to ride out the storm, and would he have tried?
I think there's no question it would have been very different had there one been a Fox News. He was instrumental in the idea of creating a Fox News. I think it would have been a whole different dynamic. But also, you got to remember the huge difference between Trump and Nixon is that Nixon, it clearly has a conscience. Is he ruthless at times? You bet. Did he override his conscience many times? Yes. Was he a racist? And yes, all those things. But he did believe in one thing, which was the rule of law. And he just accepted that that was the only way the system would work, if you did honor the Constitution. And I think that's the only reason he finally decided, I'm not going to put the country through an impeachment. The other problem is he lost his staff by the time he resigned. They were the key players didn't think he should survive or would survive, and they were running for the rafters.
One last question about you. You graduate from law school at 26 years old. You become the White House counsel by the time you're 31. And by the time you're 35, you find yourself a central player in a great political scandal. And Richard Nixon is pardoned by Gerald Ford. How did that sit with you then? And how does it sit with you now? You spoke a little bit about it in the documentary.
Yeah, my initial reaction was I thought it grossly unfair to Haldeman, Ehrlichman, everybody else involved, to give the president a pass when it was clear all this was done for him. These weren't freelancers. These were people who were trying to please the man who got the pardon. It just seemed unbalanced. I understood it, though, that he clearly didn't want to be burdened, as he would have been, by a trial of Richard Nixon. I don't think, based on reading the records of the prosecutor's office, they would have indicted Nixon. And the reason they wouldn't have is because he couldn't get a fair trial. That's the issue today with Trump. How does a man that high and that conspicuous and that and as circusy as it would be, get a fair trial? How do you find a jury that can even make those deliberations, knowing that this is the first president to ever be in front of a jury? I think Georgia might do it, and that's where it should happen, at a lower level than at the national level. And I think it's a travesty either way it plays to not indict Trump, who has clearly, conspicuously violated many laws. Certainly the law that got everybody at Watergate was the general conspiracy statute of the federal government. Well, there are multiple conspiracies that Trump is not only involved in, he created them knowingly, openly. No issue of criminal intent here.
And yet he's the front runner for the Republican presidential nomination in 2024.
He is. The Republican Party of today is a very different party. It's smaller than it's ever been, and its ideology is radical, which there are no moderates in the Republican Party. There are people who say, well, I'll look at the candidate and decide who I'm going to vote. I know I have a lot of Republican friends who voted for Trump because of the economic side of it, the tax side of it. And many of them regret doing it, but they say my selfish sense had me voting for Republican Party, not for necessarily Donald Trump. So it's a real problem. But one of the things that one of the reasons that Watergate is instructive is it shows us how fragile the system is. And it is being tested now much, much more seriously than during Watergate.
What do you want people to say about John Dean? Clearly, Watergate is going to be part of your epitaph, but what do you want people to say about you?
Obviously, someone who's been through what I've been through and is as public as I am, I've been asked this question many times. My answer always comes back to the fact I have no control over it. So my wanting or not wanting has little relevance. My hope is that he was a truth teller. That's the best I could hope for.
You've shared a lot. And the question is, you know, what lesson do we derive that we can apply to today?
Well, let me tell you, I may be naive, but I believed back during Watergate, I believe it today, that the truth has its own way of getting out. And Trump can't suppress it. Republicans can't suppress it. And the game they're playing, the dangerous game they're playing with democracy now, they will take their full share of blame because the truth shows they own it.
Yeah, well, I would also say another thing that the Watergate story shows, and that we're relearning again today through these hearings, that democracy does rely on the good will of people who are actors in the process. And we were able to inaugurate a president who was duly elected by the American people. because there were people up and down the line, including the president's own Justice Department, that refused to bow to pressure. And that is an inspiring part of the story. One hopes that the wall holds and that we can navigate through this sort of sordid episode in our history.
Dangerous times, no question.
But always good to be with you, my friend. Thank you so much, John Dean.
David, a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Allison Siegel. The show is also produced by Miriam Finder Annenberg, Jeff Fox, and Hannah Grace McDonald. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Rafina Ahmad, Courtney Koop, Ashley Lusk, and Megan Marcus. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.